Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1 p.m. and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 22nd. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I would talk about a number of different topics in here today. What I really want to talk about is debt and manufacturing and globalization. And I've got a couple of different charts I'd like to go through with you. This was one that I saw earlier on this week, and it was that the Social Security cash surplus or deficit is rolling over. That the topic of unfunded liabilities has largely been swept to the side over the course of the last 18 months, not least because of the tax cuts. There was this hope, or one might think of as wishful thinking maybe, that the massive fiscal bump that the Trump administration was putting in place was going to feed through into long-term growth that would suddenly massively increase tax revenues and be able to fund Social Security. But there is a very real prospect that later this year we're going to see this become a much more important topic. It is that Social Security is now in a deficit, and that it is going to the quantity of money in the trust fund is going to fall precipitously over the course of the next decade, that it could be all but expended by the time we get to 2030. This is an enormously important topic because it's one of the untouchables in terms of the economy, that there are an increasingly large number of people who are retiring. One of the interesting charts that one we could associate with this particular phenomenon is the participation rate. When we look at the US participation rate on aggregate, it really hasn't gone anywhere over the course of the last few years. That we had a bump, but it has not translated into additional participation in the labor force over the course of the last 2 years. And part of the reason for that is because, despite the fact that there are more jobs and that there is a dearth of people to fill them, there are an increasing number of people that are just dropping out of the labor force. So that is part of the reason. Now, then the question is, how is this calculated? Are people that are retiring included in the labor force participation rate? That's a rather large question. It's not something I have an answer to. I'll have to do some additional research to look at the minutiae of how it's calculated. But there is one conclusion that we can certainly draw from looking at this chart. It's that it is not going up. And that is something that is important, because we are in the throes of an economic expansion that has been largely fueled by liquidity in the primary instance, and then secondarily by fiscal expansion. We have had a translation in the provision of liquidity from a dependence on monetary accommodation to fiscal accommodation. And so far, that transition has been pretty just seamless in terms of the provision of liquidity. But there is an important point that is also worth looking at the moment, and it's that when you look at the aggregate balance sheets of central banks, they are declining. That the peak was approximately 21 trillion earlier this year. It's currently 20 trillion, almost exactly 20 trillion as of the close today. And this is important. This is the biggest pullback we've seen since at least 2016. Prior to that, the biggest pullback we'd seen was at the end of 2008. Now, we know that central bank largesse has been one of the primary avenues with which liquidity has been able to enter the market, and it has helped to inflate what I would consider to be the biggest bull market in history in government bonds. But there is the realistic possibility that it is ending. And there is, when we think about it in those terms, then we know the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet. And we also know that the pace of the advance is going to be picking up over the course of the next few months. So that is going to accelerate the decline in the size of central bank balance sheets. We also know that the ECB is going to be reducing its purchases of bonds, and that is going to that they're going to stop buying in September. So that's on the one hand, we have the quantity of bonds that are being added to balance sheets being reduced, and on the other, the quantity of new bonds being created is also increasing. So what that means is that there's going to be more supply on the market. Now, when we think about that and what repercussions that is going to have on government bond markets, well, we can see, for example, that US 10-year Treasury yields have been ranging, albeit in a somewhat volatile manner, around this 3% level. They have not been pulling back, though, and not certainly not in the kind of dynamic way that we saw back in 2013 during the taper tantrum. And really, a sustained move below the trend mean would be required to suggest that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, there are two important aspects to this market. One, of course, is that there is additional new supply coming through, that you do not get a fiscal bump for free, that it does require additional debt to be issued. And with the central bank reducing the size of its balance sheet and no longer buying as many, it puts the onus for buying up these bonds onto the public markets. And so far, so good. People have been willing to buy these bonds because they're getting a somewhat better yield. And you are now getting a yield premium by buying treasuries versus the S&P 500, for example. But that yield premium is really quite low. But we know that there is a lot more debt going to be coming onto the market, that the Federal Reserve is going, the pace of the runoff or its quantitative tightening program is going to pick up. And that there is plenty of additional debt that needs to be rolled over. Not only is there a lot of debt that needs to be rolled over, but that there's going to be new debt issued to fund the fiscal largesse. But how sustainable is that when we know, for example, that Social Security is going to be running a deficit? There's going to have to be some measure put in place to help to bolster the finances of Social Security. Well, one, of course, would be that they extend the retirement age. People are living a lot longer, so logically they should be able to work for longer, and they could eliminate the decision that people have to retire early. But of course, this is not just a US problem. This is a global problem, and the pensions are critically under funded in a large number of countries. This is something that is going to become an electoral issue that we are already talking about inequality. We're already talking about the revolt against the status quo, talking about populism, but we have not yet begun to talk about a war in terms of generations, because the people who have money are generally older, and it is falling on the young people to fund the pensions of older people, and there seem to be rather a lot of older people. Well, the one thing that older people have is that they vote, and that we saw, I think, abundant evidence of that in Donald Trump's victory, that it was generally older people voted for him. And that is also, we can see, for example, that when he was negotiating with Kim Jong-un, that one of the things that was requested was assistance with repatriating bodies from fallen soldiers, despite the fact that the Korean War was not far off 50 years ago. So that is a, I think, a further testament to the fact that that we are perhaps moving towards generational warfare, which is potentially out there on the horizon. It what it suggests is that rather than people really thinking about what the outcome of the midterm elections are going to be in the USA, it's probably going to be the next presidential election is going to be really interesting, because it is at that point that the deficits in terms of Social Security are going to be really rather urgent. And we are also at the point where we know that we are in the mature stage of a medium-term bull market. One thing that people have been asking about is what do I think of the Shiller PE ratio? And when we think about what exactly we have in terms of that longer term perspective in the CAPE, the cyclically adjusted PE, we can see very clearly that the cyclically adjusted PE is at the second highest level it's ever been at. So we know that by and large that on a 10-year average, then the and th that is how it's calculated. It's a long-term average that on the basis of that average, the PE is rather high. But this is not a consistent chart, so it's hard to predict. Also, it's not a timing indicator. There is obviously the risk that eventually we're going to get mean reversion. But since the era of globalization began, we're talking about global earnings when we think about the S&P 500, whereas that was not strictly a global index back in the 1900 or 1930 or 40 or 50. So there is the argument that it could be that the mean should be higher, so therefore we don't get the same kind of mean reversions that we might have been used to previously. Then there is the argument, there is the additional point that because this is not a consistent chart, and therefore it is less prone to the kind of analysis that we generally do, that we don't know where the peak is going to be. Just because it's at the second highest level does not mean that it can't go to the first highest. That by the time the secular bull market has run its course, the CAPE could be at a new all-time high, and that we could have not just somewhat expensive valuations, but extraordinarily expensive valuations. After all, that is how bubbles generally tend to get, that we generally expect that we're going to get extraordinary valuations on on a stock market, not just on an individual sector or on individual equities, but on a whole stock market. Now, I think it is arguable, for example, that we do have very aggressive multiples on companies like Netflix. That the estimated PE is 143, the historic PE is 260. For Amazon, then we also have these very high PE ratios with an estimated PE of 137. So I think that is important. And we also know that when these shares do become really rather overextended relative to the trend mean, then they do pull back. And when we look at Amazon, it is susceptible to some pause of consolidation, and over the last two sessions, it does look like that is beginning. One thing that I find interesting is that, and this is simply just intelligence from Mrs. Tracy's business, but Amazon has been losing a lot of inventory, and their quality of customer service is deteriorating. And not only are they losing inventory, but then there is increasing competition on the marketplace and an increasing amount of fraud. That competition is increasing, and Amazon doesn't appear to have any way in which to combat fraudulent reviews, losing inventory, shipments going missing, and these are, and then you send 100 boxes and 90 get checked in, or you send 25 boxes and 27 get checked in. These are the kinds of things that suggest that a system is under stress, and I don't see that there has been any discussion of that kind of aspect to Amazon in any part of the media. So I'm thinking that it is due some consolidation, and that it is only a matter of time before these stresses in the system start to come out. And it is at an awfully high valuation. So I don't think that Amazon is the kind of share where there is no risk, but rather that there is certainly risk when we have such a very wide overextension relative to the trend mean. Well, then we also have the reality that the technology sector has been resurgent, and most particularly cloud computing. But it isn't simply that you have cloud computing, because The pace of technological innovation has been accelerating now for decades, and it has been driven in large part by Moore's Law, but not only by Moore's Law. Moore's Law is most specifically attached to semiconductors. Well, semiconductor efficiency, or Moore's Law, basically ended in 2016. It became much more unpredictable, and what that has created was the catalyst for the growth of cloud computing and server farms, and it has been the evolution of the server and server or data centers that has helped to stoke the interest in companies like Amazon and Google, and then also Facebook and Netflix. These are all companies that have benefited from the growth of data centers, that they're providing software as a service, they're providing services via broadband rather than producing widgets that we hold in our hands. The we are moving our There is I think a growing argument that we have reached the peak of personal computing, and that increasingly we're going to have more software and more services delivered over the internet. And that is going to require an infrastructure build. That is the primary argument behind 5G. 5G is not only going to power the Internet of Things, it's also going to power the access to progressively more advanced services, not least artificial intelligence and deep learning that we're going to get from these big server companies. And then we also have the potential that it is what is going to be required to deliver autonomous vehicles, and when we think about what the outlook is for the broad market, then this continues to represent the sector that has been doing best. But that doesn't mean that it can pull back and that it is going to rise indefinitely. And in tandem with that, with the outperformance of the technology sector, what we have is a new business model, and it is the subscription-oriented model. That, because historically the technology sector has been highly cyclical, and they were subject to very lumpy cash flows, which created very volatile ranges, and Microsoft is a good example of that. That every time it brought out a new iteration of Windows, then sales picked up, and then the cost of maintaining both the new version and the old version, and then the cost of coming up with the next new version, that weighed on earnings, so prices went sideways or down until the next new one came out. Well, that kind of lumpy cash flow is something that investors find very hard to model, and therefore you get a lower multiple. But when you adopt a subscription business model, then you've got earnings that are very easily modelable, and you don't have to worry about what the new product is going to sell because your sales are already baked into the price. And then when you want to raise your prices, well, it's very easy that you can raise your price on the subscription by an incremental amount that consumers are less likely to resist. And that has translated into the outperformance of the subscription business model. Where it has taken particular effect is within new services. So the kind of data center or service-oriented companies that are delivered over the internet have taken to the subscription model with alacrity. And then when we think about the gaming sector, then microtransactions are one of the primary ways in which the large gaming companies have been able to generate their income. So there you have, for example, Adobe Instruments, Google, Amazon, Apple, Autodesk, Blue Apron, Cisco Systems, Dassault, Electronic Arts, and we have a high degree of commonality in these subscription-oriented business models. So that is the new business model that is going with the fact that we have a transition that has gone on in terms of the way that the market views the outlook, considering the fact that we have reached a point where Moore's law is no longer predictable. Well, what that also means is that the traditional companies that did benefit from Moore's law, not least Intel, AMD, and ASML, and a whole host of others, they're going to have to double down and come up with something that is even more impressive. And that's why we have such a high degree of investment into optical computing, the quantum computing, the exploration of memristors. All of those are designed to overcome the limitations of silicon, which has been split down to not far off the width of one atom. So then that is where the future of personal and server-based computing is likely to arise from, and there is a needs-must element to it. So it's quite likely that we're in fact going to get that. Now, if we have the fact that technological innovation is accelerating, a lot of people tend to think of technology as inherently deflationary, and it is, because the whole purpose of technology is that you can do more with less. And a question that I've been asked in just about every country I visited to give talks to over the course of the last few years is, when is a robot going to take my job? But I've been thinking about that now for years, and I think I've come up with an answer that at least seems to me to make sense. Well, when we think about it in simple terms, we look at the countries that have got the most robots. And I have a graphic to illustrate that. Well, then we look at them, and they are the Republic of South Korea, Singapore, Germany, Japan, Sweden. And certainly the first four have got vibrant manufacturing sectors. And if it was the reality that we had a large number of robots that were displacing workers, well, then the manufacturing sectors of these countries would have disappeared. But that is simply not the case. Then if we go back and look, then the manufacturing sector of the USA has been deteriorating for a long time. But the reality is that the number of robots per worker is highly concentrated in the semiconductor business within the USA, and that outside of that business, that particular sector, we do not have a great deal of automation. And that is part of the reason why you do not have the US manufacturing sector rallying in a very dynamic manner. And I'll pull up that chart, because one thing that is I think really very illustrative of this point is the decline that we've had in manufacturing for the USA over the course of the last 18 years. That when people talk about the recovery in manufacturing, it has to be put in the context of the previous decline, and that decline was incredible. Between 2000 and approximately 2010, the number of people working in manufacturing in the USA almost halved. So that did not happen because of technology. Technological innovation has been going on for years. It happened most particularly because that was when China got a permanent position within the WTO and became the self-styled manufacturer to the world. I had a conversation with a Chinese entrepreneur about a year ago, and the conversation that we had has been sort of sticking with me, that he had a lighting business and a logistics business, and he was importing wrought iron lamps from China, which are obviously very heavy and very bulky, which twinned very well with his logistics business, and he was drop shipping those to some of the biggest lighting companies in the USA, and also had a number of different websites that he was selling them on. But it turned out that he had spent the early part of his career traveling all over places like Finland and Sweden, and what he had been working to do was buying up paper manufacturing equipment. And because the competition in China was rising so quickly that the paper mills were under a great deal of pressure, and what they were doing was Chinese entrepreneurs that were getting very, excuse me, cheap loans from the government were going over and buying up all of the machinery for creating paper, shipping it back to China, reestablishing it, and basically recreating the manufacturing process in China. What had effectively been done is that they had literally picked up manufacturing out of Scandinavia and dropped it into China. But that's not the only sector that was achieved in. They did that in just about everything, most particularly in the production of smaller widgets that had previously required employment for millions of people in North America and in Europe. The production of shoes and fabric, the production of nuts and bolts, everything moved to China, and the manufacturing sectors were eviscerated in North America and Europe. Well, we were fed the line back when that was proposed that by increasing employment in manufacturing, by helping countries like China to lift themselves out of poverty, that much larger markets would be created for the goods of our existing companies, and that they would be able to create global business models, and that has happened. But at the same time, they have also closed their markets to higher value items and social media and services and technology services that could be delivered, and they have championed their domestic companies in a very protectionist environment. Then it was hoped that when GDP per capita, or excuse me, it's GNP per capita, got up to about $4,500 to $5,000, then historically liberalism tends to flourish, but that did not happen. And in fact, if we think about what are the primary traits of improving governance, well, we generally tend to think of them as respect for minority shareholder interests, an independent judiciary, and an independent press, a free press. And China doesn't have any of those. In addition to that, it now is a dictatorship, and in addition to that, they are engaged in this social credit score testing, which is scoring people on everything from whether they're a jaywalker to whether they give to charity, that how quickly they pay their utility bills, and the number of metrics that are being collected about individuals and their way of life is increasing. What is in fact going on is that it is social conditioning on a grand scale, and in addition to that, there is an outright war on freedom of association. That is most particularly going on in Xinjiang, where up to 10% of the population has already been incarcerated. So we did not get the liberalism from the rise of China, and the control that the Communist Party has over the population is increasing. Well, then if we think about the UK, and the UK is way ahead of the curve in terms of the decline of manufacturing compared to the USA. This is manufacturing in the UK from the 1980, from about 1980. And every time there's a recession, they lose about 1 million people working in manufacturing. Well, there were news headlines back in December saying that manufacturing was at a 4-year high. But anyone who has ever looked at a chart can see that this recovery has been paltry, and I think that's a very kind way of considering it. And that the next time there is a recession, that there is a strong likelihood that manufacturing in the UK will all but disappear. You had Airbus today saying that if Brexit goes ahead without a deal, that they are going to pull out of the UK. Rolls-Royce is restructuring and is firing thousands of people. And this is before we get to the outcome of Brexit. So this is important because when we think about what is so important about manufacturing jobs, I think there is this is one of the most important things. I went through the Office of National Statistics in the UK, and I aggregated wages by sector over the last 12 months. And these were non-seasonal, so I just took the last 12 months and averaged the wages, and these are per week. And we often hear, and I think that this is perhaps the most important fact, is that our economies are now service oriented. We don't need manufacturing any longer because it's that we have evolved beyond the manufacturing sector, which tends to be grubby and is really not for higher minded individuals. Well, when we say that we are now a service oriented society, well, what people generally tend to think of as services is information and communications. That it is the information technology sector that is the real growth in the market, and that these are high paying jobs. They're in the top three. But that is simply not the case. That there are only approximately 1.5 million people working in the information and communication sector in the UK out of a total job market of approximately 33.7 million people. But services is an awfully broad category, and accommodation, retail, other services, arts and recreation, public administration, health, education, real estate, these are all service oriented. Well, if we just look at the lower half of the table, then wages per week are anywhere between £275 and £560. It's in the financial services sector that we have very high wages, the highest in the UK. Well, this is also important that it's in manufacturing that you tend to have some of the higher wages. Well, there are other wages that are manufacturing other comes in there, and then food and beverage manufacturing comes in around 550. So if you're in manufacturing, you're earning a little bit more than the average nurse. And of course, the health sector is heavily skewed by the fact that it includes doctors and consultants. So that number is probably not accurate for nurses, and teachers tend to get paid a bit more than nurses. But if you're in other manufacturing or food and beverage manufacturing, you're earning somewhere between the two. And this is the primary benefit of manufacturing jobs. They do tend to be better paid than working in a hotel, working as a cleaner. And when we think about the services sector, this is a complete obfuscation of the way that the economy has evolved. This is as true in the UK as it is in the USA. It's the exact same in Australia. The one benefit that countries like Australia and Canada have is that they have a lot more mining jobs. Well, why is it that coal miners tend to be so argumentative? Why is it that they tend to get out and march and protest? It's because mining pays. It is one of the key sectors that really does pay very attractive wages. And this is important because when we think about why have we had such a rise in populism? Why have we had this massive reaction against the status quo? It's because people that used to earn what was considered a good wage, something that you could look after your family and have something left over, those jobs are now in China, and the likelihood of them ever coming back is quite low. China is moving up the value chain in terms of its manufacturing, and that means that they are aiming squarely for the higher paid manufacturing jobs. And That is the key challenge. That is one of the reasons why the Trump administration is targeting the China Made in 2025 program, because China has absolutely no intent of standing still. They've been buying US treasuries for the last decade, and they've pretty much stopped. The size of their foreign exchange reserves has also pretty much stopped. And China named the USA as a strategic competitor late last year. They want to become a superpower. And in order to become a superpower, what they need is high-tech manufacturing. Well, because Moore's Law has basically stopped, they have now got less pressure to continue to innovate in terms of basic semiconductor manufacturing. That increases the potential that China is going to have a domestic semiconductor manufacturing sector, which it does not have today. At that point, China will be technologically self-sufficient because they are already investing in quantum computing. They're already investing in optical computing. These are sectors that do not yet exist, and therefore, it is a competition to who is going to get there first. They are investing heavily in artificial intelligence because a lot of artificial intelligence is about just the grunt work of labeling photos. And when you've got millions of people, then that is something that is really quite achievable. They're concentrating on securing the access to commodities that is going to fuel not the growth of the last 20 years, but the growth of the next 20. And that means that they're very much focused on strategic resources. When we think about the fact that China is building a blue water navy and that they are now starting to build foreign military bases, one in Djibouti, they are improving relations with Sri Lanka, and they're improving relations with Myanmar. Well, we can see, therefore, that that is the trade route for oil to come out of the Middle East and into China. Obviously, their big question is what to do about the Straits of Malacca, and that is the choke point that has historically been a very strategic area within Asia. But all of these points, they are drawing a line towards a bipolar world, that China is competing not only on a manufacturing front, but on a high technology front. And it expects to be able to continue to export into our economies. And that is the big question. This is one of the, I think, the outstanding question that we have in terms of the global economy. When we think about the outlook for stock markets, then the Dow gold ratio has got about 35 years between the peaks, and this ratio continues to march higher. So, despite the volatility we've had on the Dow, gold prices have been pulling back over the course of the last few months. And gold has got this saucering pattern over the last 3 years, and it is now right in the region of its progression of higher reaction lows. And if it's going to rally, well, this is around the time where we could anticipate that that might start to happen. I don't believe that China is ready for a trade war or for an outright Cold War right away. But that is the way things are developing. It may take them another decade to get their military up to the level where they could be truly competitive. It will take them a decade to establish military bases around the Pacific. And that is something that they are certainly going to try and achieve. So therefore, the time to combat expansionism from China is today. What is happening in Vietnam is particularly interesting because there are street protests with about Chinese association with the domestic Communist Party and the rollout of a great firewall similar to what China has. And the Vietnamese index has pulled back to the region of the trend mean. So this is about where if support is going to be found, it needs to happen pretty soon. And what that also helps to illustrate is China's adventurism, that the countries that it is first attempting to influence are obviously those with which it has a border, and that the likelihood is that they will move on from there. The big question, obviously, we've talked about China's ambition. Now the question is whether it can achieve it. China has got these very global ambitions, and one has to question whether that is reflective of hubris. The stock market has been pulling back in a dynamic manner over the last couple of months. Well, we know that the stock market is very highly orchestrated by the central administration, and they can influence what goes on in the market. What I think is interesting is if we look at a company like Minsheng Bank, which did spectacularly well when it broke out of its base back in 20 or 2006, but now it looks like it's on the cusp of breaking downwards. That the course of the trend has got type 3 top formation characteristics. Minsheng Bank has classically been the bank that was given the most leeway, that it was the only bank that was allowed to remain in private hands. So it has got, it's not, by no means the largest bank, but it may be a reasonable barometer of what the actual conditions are in the market. And if we look at the broad banking sector, then it's not looking great. The only thing we could say is that there's a short-term oversold condition, but there's no sign yet that this downtrend is over. We know that China is leaning on the shadow banking sector and that they are trying to excise leverage from the system. And they need to do that if they're going to achieve their longer-term ambitions. They need to have a steady domestic market if they're going to achieve their global ambitions. So they are instituting remedial activity today in an effort to be healthier for their big expansion internationally later. And that is reflecting in the underperformance of the banking sector. We also have to consider that because the standards of governance are deteriorating, especially from the perspective of private investors, then China deserves an additional risk premium. There is a reason why the PE on the banks is 6.6 and it is still going down, because the only other market that tends to have valuations similar is Russia, where you have a PE of 6.5 on the Russian market. And I would say that the standards of governance from the perspective of an investor are about equal in Russia and China. Well, because of the strength of the US dollar, and because we now are in a situation where Wall Street is the best performing market, and because the dollar continues to rally, that is putting downward pressure on the currencies of just about all emerging markets. The renminbi is breaking down below the trend mean this week, and when we think about the outlook for trade wars, the China has got a long history of using the currency as a policy tool, and they will devalue the currency. That also means that the likelihood is there's going to be a flood of money that's going to want to leave China as a result of that. Again, that's not a great sign of confidence from domestic investors in the administration, and it's also reflective of the fact that we do have declining governance in China. But if we are moving towards a bipolar world, the real region that is up for grabs is Europe, because the USA is looking increasingly more insular. And with the rise of automation, there is the potential that we may not get the repatriation of old manufacturing jobs, but that there will be more customization of the manufacturing sector in future. And that does have the potential to create independent centers of gravity in terms of economics. The USA is still a massive consumer, and there is the realistic possibility that through automation that they will be able to manufacture more of what they consume. And then, of course, you have oil. And the USA is almost energy independent. And because of OPEC's obfuscation this week, we've had a very, very strong rally in West Texas Intermediate in here today. It was up over $3. That's an emphatic upside weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean, and it suggests that we are going to see higher prices. That the next area of potential resistance is probably somewhere around $80. When we look at Brent crude, then there is the potential that we are also going to see higher prices from here. That we've had a pretty emphatic pop on the upside in here this week, but Brent still has a progression of lower rally highs, so it is going to have to follow through on the upside next week to confirm the low. Now, if we think about what is it that is going to amplify a lot of the issues that people are worried about, it's probably going to be the next recession. Well, surging oil prices have generally been a contributor to recessions, and we know that the yield curve spread is contracting. And it's currently at 35 basis points. And it has been contracting pretty steadily just about all year. Because the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet and it's also raising interest rates. So we are getting a double whammy in terms of quantitative tightening. And eventually that is going to choke off the liquidity environment. So when we get to a point where this goes inverted, we will have a lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months for the next recession. What is particularly interesting is that high yield bonds have been completely inert in terms of the spread. And when that eventually breaks out, well, then that will also be an indicator that we're going to be getting tighter monetary conditions. Unemployment is not a lead indicator, it's probably more like a coincident indicator, but unemployment is still trending lower. And when it eventually stops trending lower, well, then we'll know that we're closer to a recession. We also know that LIBOR rates have gone from basically nothing in 2015 to 2.33%, and this continues to look like it is going to move higher. So we know that monetary conditions, liquidity conditions are getting tighter. The strength of the US dollar is having an impact on just about all emerging markets. And eventually, the higher cost of funding is going to have a stronger influence. So then the question is, how much further is the dollar going to rally? Well, the most important thing is that it already went down a lot between from the end of 2016 until the beginning of 2018. And it hasn't even retraced half of that decline when we look at the dollar index. When we look at the Asia dollar index, then it hasn't unwound even half of that decline either. But here we have Asian currencies pulling back below the trend mean in a dynamic manner. And the Latin America dollar index, which is heavily weighted by the real and the Mexican peso, is at a new low. So this is where the dollar didn't really give up any of its previous advance. So this is also, of course, representative of countries that are either heavily reliant on commodities like Brazil or on the largesse of its northern neighbor, Mexico. Well, when we look at the Mexican peso, then it has bounced in here this week, but it has got a lot of work to do, and it has an election coming up where you're going to have well, potentially going to have a left-wing populist that is heading the government. So there is risk that is outstanding in the Mexican peso. When we think about what the outlook is for a lot of different emerging market currencies, then What we have seen this week is that there are some short-term oversold conditions for these markets. So the dollar is unlikely to rally in a straight line. When, for example, even if we look at Turkey, where the potential outcome of the upcoming election is going to be a lot tighter than President Erdogan might be comfortable with, we're starting to see at least some steadying of the lira coming through. What that suggests is that the epicenter of risk, despite the fact that emerging market currencies have been pulling back, that the bigger risk is in the outlook for China and Europe. And that, I think, is where the primary risks are. Well, these are emerging risks, and it isn't something that is just over right now. In the meantime, when we look at the consistency of trends, then it is certainly Wall Street that is continuing to do well. It is being led higher by the technology sector. There are challenges that are outstanding. And then, whenever we have the next recession, the chances are that we're going to be set up for some very attractive buying opportunities. And I think that I've spent most of the last hour thinking about the risks, because I think this is not a bad time to be thinking about risks, because we know that there are problems that are out there, and that the rise of populism is something that is a theme that is unlikely to simply disappear, and not least because the threat to living standards has not been diluted. In fact, it's probably getting even more intense. But the more important point in the short term is that an increasing number of markets are breaking on the upside, that the Russell 2000 has broken up, and it is susceptible now to some potential for consolidation. The Nasdaq also broke out, and it is susceptible to some consolidation. But in the absence of a clear pullback, then, and most particularly a sustained move below the trend mean, then I think we can continue to conclude that we're still in a bull market environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.